This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's been a month since the new Medicare prescription drug plan went into effect. Tonight, in his State of the Union address, President Bush is expected to call for further changes in how Americans pay for health care. My guest, Jonathan Oberlander, is the author of the book, The Political Life of Medicare. He's an associate professor of social medicine in the School of Medicine at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. The president is advocating private medical accounts. Would you describe what that means?
The idea is that people will buy high-deductible health insurance, high-deductible meaning at least $2,000, and then you can put money aside in a tax-sheltered health savings account, and you would use that money to pay your routine medical expenses.
What are considered to be some of the benefits and some of the shortcomings of this approach?
Some of the benefits of it include the fact that it's portable, meaning now when you lose your job, you lose your health insurance. With a health savings account, you can take that money and you can move it with you to your next job, or if you don't have a job, you can still access it. Another benefit would be that, according to Lisa, folks who are in favor of this, people feel the cost of medical care more directly. They say they have more skin in the game. In other words, right now, if you're covered by comprehensive health insurance, you don't have a lot of incentive to shop around for the lowest cost care.
And what are some of the problems?
Well, I think there are some very serious problems with this. One is it's a very regressive way to finance medical care, because what you're doing is you're really shifting the burden to those who use medical care the most. So people who have chronic illnesses, who are really sick, they're going to be paying out of those high deductibles year after year after year, and they're not going to build up very much money, if any money at all, in the health savings account. Another disadvantage of this is I really don't think it's going to control costs very well. 10% of Americans account for 70% of spending on medical care. And, you know, their medical care utilization is not going to be influenced by the introduction of co-payments and these deductibles, so it's probably not going to do a lot. A final thing that I think is important is it could have a potentially very damaging effect on the risk pool. One of the problems with American medical care is it's very, very fragmented already. And what you're doing with health savings accounts is you've created a form of insurance that is beneficial for people who are healthy. If those Americans pull out of the regular insurance market and join health savings accounts, the rest of Americans are going to be in insurance plans that become increasingly expensive.
The president in his State of the Union address is expected to also speak in support of tax deductions for out-of-pocket medical expenses. What does that mean?
Right now, there is a tax advantage to getting health insurance through your employer. And a lot of people have pointed out that it's really unfair for those that can't get health insurance through their employer that they can't enjoy the same tax deduction. So what they're proposing is to make this more generalizable and sort of level the playing field. I think it's an interesting proposal. The problem with it is it's really not going to do much for the uninsured, and it's not going to do much for healthcare spending.
Does this benefit people who are in high tax brackets more than it benefits people who are in lower tax brackets?
Yes. And in general, health savings accounts, back to what we were discussing earlier, are a much better deal for the healthy and the wealthy and represent another form of a sort of tax shelter. Because they're in higher tax brackets, they can put money away in their health savings account that is tax sheltered. And so they benefit more than folks at the lower end of the income distribution. They're also going to be in more of a financial position to do that.
Let's talk about the new prescription drug benefit. You've written a book on the politics of Medicare. How would you describe how the prescription drug benefit is doing so far?
Not well. It's been a confusing start. There's been a lot of chaos, a lot of serious problems, and frankly, enrollment is not very good so far.
Interested in what you've learned about what happened behind the scenes in the drafting of this prescription drug benefit. There have been a lot of questions raised about the role that lobbyists played and how that affected the final writing of the bill. Would you summarize what we know so far about that?
Well, I think the big picture to keep in mind is that this bill was written in large part for the prescription drug industry in the United States. the pharmaceutical industry for many years has opposed a Medicare drug benefit because they were worried that once the government got involved, they would start setting prices. And so the terms on which this legislation was finally enacted were meant to be very friendly to the drug industry in order to get their cooperation with the program. Now, in terms of the actual drafting of the bill, there was serious question of conflict of interest. You had the former head of the agency that runs Medicare and Medicaid, Tom Scully, who right after the legislation was finished, left the government in order to become a healthcare lobbyist. You had another member of Congress who was on a committee that oversaw the writing of the legislation, who went to become the head of PhRMA, which is the trade group for the prescription drug industry. So there's no question that lobbyists were involved in this. And again, the big picture is that this bill was written on terms purposely that are very friendly to the drug industry.
What is friendly about the terms of the prescription drug benefit part of the plan?
The two most important aspects of this legislation that make it a good deal for the industry, at least in the short run, is number one, the way this benefit works, you have to get it from private insurer. You have to get it not from the government. The government subsidizes you, but you've got to pick a private plan, and that's very different from the way the rest of Medicare works. The rest of Medicare is directly operated by the federal government. The second element of the bill that is really friendly to the industry is the bill prohibits Medicare from negotiating drug prices. And this is something that, of course, states do in the Medicaid program, the Veterans Administration does. Medicare would have tremendous power, tremendous market power. There are 42 million Medicare beneficiaries that would be purchasing drugs on behalf of. And that marketing power is precisely why the government was prohibited from directly negotiating prices.
Do you think that the new Medicare prescription benefit represents a change of philosophy in how Medicare is administered?
Absolutely. When Medicare was enacted in 1965, it reflected the politics of the time. You know, I always call it a programmatic flower child. It was a very liberal program that was based on a philosophy of universalism, of social insurance, a philosophy where the federal government was really responsible for the benefit. And, you know, sometimes we talk about single-payer health insurance in the United States, and Medicare really is a single-payer program where the government is the one responsible for the insurance. What we have seen in Medicare politics over time is the rise of a market model that believes instead of government running insurance, the market should run insurance. And government's role is simply to subsidize beneficiaries to go out in the private insurance market and choose their own plans. And this is really a fundamental shift in Medicare.
Who's advocating that, and why do the advocates want that?
Generally, conservatives and Republicans support that vision of the Medicare program. They argue that, you know, the federal government shouldn't be setting prices. It shouldn't be making choices on behalf of beneficiaries who have a better idea of what they want. They think it's a more efficient and a cheaper way to provide health care to the elderly and disabled in Medicare. Also in favor of having Medicare go in that direction is, of course, the insurance industry, because there are 42 million beneficiaries in Medicare right now. By 2030, that's nearly going to double to 77 million. That's a huge market and a potentially very profitable market. And if you move Medicare in a private direction, they stand to make a lot of money from that decision.
One of the problems with Medicare is that as the baby boom begins to retire, it's going to pose a really overwhelming expense, far different from the expense when Medicare was created in the mid-60s. So would privatizing the program and bringing, you know, private insurance companies into it solve the problem of the medical expense posed to the federal budget by the retirement of the baby boom?
No. You know, there's no doubt that there's an immense challenge ahead of Medicare. In many ways, the financing crisis, so-called crisis in Social Security, is really a modest problem. Medicare's financial problems are much greater in scope, much greater in complexity. At best, those reforms would save a very modest amount of money. I'm skeptical that they would do even that. There's no way to fund Medicare into the future and double its population without putting more money into the program, and that means higher taxes. There's just no way to do it. On the other hand, we need to recognize that Medicare's financial problems are not really of Medicare's own makings. What this reflects is broader problems in the American healthcare system. We have a very, very expensive healthcare system. 16% of the American economy goes to healthcare, which is much more than any other industrialized democracy in the world. If we don't take care of healthcare spending in the rest of the healthcare system, there is no way we're going to be able to control costs in the Medicare program.
My guest is Jonathan Oberlander, author of The Political Life of Medicare. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jonathan Oberlander, the author of The Political Life of Medicare. He's an associate professor of social medicine in the School of Medicine at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. There's the question of choice. The prescription drug benefit offers a lot of choices to people who are eligible. What do you feel are the lessons so far in the role of choice in a healthcare program for the elderly?
This program is really a test of consumer-driven healthcare, which is something that the president wants to pursue more broadly. And the idea of consumer-driven healthcare is we need to make medical care more like every other product that consumers go out and they shop for, and they look carefully at the benefits and the costs, and they select, just like they would a computer, the health insurance plan they want the most. And I think the lesson, we're early on here, but the lesson so far is you can have too much choice and it can be too confusing. You know, this program is an economist's dream to have all these Medicare beneficiaries making these decisions, making these choices. But in many respects, it's a patient's nightmare. In where I am in North Carolina, there are 53 different plans that beneficiaries can choose from. And it's a very, very complicated choice that requires not just a lot of patience, but a lot of computer skills. And I think what you have is a theory in search of a population, that theory being consumer-driven healthcare, and they found the wrong population. And so far, only 3.5 million Medicare beneficiaries have signed up voluntarily for this program, which really augurs for big trouble down the road. And that is in large part because they are paralyzed by too much choice.
The Medicare prescription benefit program is brand new. The problems haven't been ironed out yet. But what provisions are there for ironing out the problems? Do you expect that there will be some kind of major or minor reform as we see how the program's actually shaking out?
Some of the problems that are going on right now are simply because this is a new program, and there have been computer glitches, miscommunication between the federal government and insurers, problems with pharmacies. And I think a lot of those problems are going to be ironed out over time as people gain more experience with this benefit. But I think this is not just a matter of bad planning. What you have here is a bad theory, and it's going to be very hard to make this work smoothly, this vision of consumer-driven healthcare for the elderly and for the disabled. In terms of whether this benefit is going to be changed or whether we can expect reform, I'm not so sure. You know, a lot of people say to me, wow, the federal government's going to have to step in. This is such a mess. This has to change. But the original Medicare program had a lot of holes in it, and it's been 40 years, and it really hasn't changed very much. And a lot of people have a lot invested to make this work. It would be very expensive to change some of the provisions. So I'm actually not that optimistic that at least in the short term, we're going to see much change. What I do know is this. This is a very unstable program in an unstable market. And it's likely that a lot of the plans, private plans that are offering insurance coverage are going to leave that market. So it may look very different 5 years from now.
You think there might be fewer programs and therefore fewer choices in a less confusing environment?
Absolutely. And the plus side of that is it'll make the choice easier. The downside is there won't be as much competition on the basis of price, and so the premiums for the plans might get more expensive over time.
There are a lot of people who are on Medicaid who were automatically switched to the new Medicare prescription drug benefit. Would you explain that automatic switch?
Yeah, this is a population that we call the dual eligible population. So in other words, seniors and Americans with disabilities who have Medicare, but they're poor enough that they also have qualified for Medicaid. And historically, Medicaid has paid their prescription drug costs, so they already had drug coverage. What has happened as a result of this bill is that entire population, about 6 million, is being switched over to the Medicare program. And so they were supposed to be automatically enrolled in private insurance plans. And in fact, they were randomly assigned, which it turns out to be a big problem, to various plans across the states. And one of the central problems that we've seen in the Medicare drug bill so far is that assignment process has not gone very well. You have these low-income dual eligibles who are often very, very sick and include folks with developmental disabilities, mental illness, and so forth, showing up at pharmacies, and their coverage isn't working the way it's supposed to. They're being told they have to pay the $250 deductible and very high copays, none of which they're supposed to pay and none of which they can afford. And there have reportedly been cases of people who had to be rehospitalized because of lapses in their medication and so forth. Of all the problems with the Medicare bill so far, I would say this is the worst.
Is anything being done to address this problem?
To their credit, a number of states have stepped up to the plate. I think about half the states now are stepping in and paying medication costs for this population that has been lost in the shuffle, including California and Maine. And it's really to the credit of the states that they're doing this. You know, they are coming to the federal government's rescue, and the Medicare program is the federal government's responsibility. And to think that in 2006, you have to have Maine and California and a bunch of other states declare emergencies and step in to make this program work, it just never should have happened.
Since each state has its own insurance programs in this new Medicare prescription drug benefit system, what happens if you move? You know, a lot of older people reach the point in their health care where they're no longer independent, and they move to another state to be closer to children or grandchildren. So if you are elderly and you do move to another state and that state doesn't have the prescription plan that you've purchased, what happens?
There's a special provision that if you move, you're going to have a chance to re-enroll. And, you know, there's a certain number of plans, I can't remember the exact number, that are national in scope. But if you do move and say you get tired of those winters up in Pennsylvania and you want to come to Florida and have some sunshine, you'll have a chance to re-enroll.
But you have to go through the whole investigation process over again of, you know, being a good consumer and finding a new plan, doing all the research.
Yes. And, you know, I think there's a broader point here. I'm not sure this is how we want elderly Americans spending their retirement. But having gone through this whole mess, and right now people have until May 15th to pick a plan, come November 15th, they're going to have to do it all over again for next year. And it's likely that there are a number of people who are going to have to switch plans because those plans aren't going to be in business anymore.
So you're saying that every year there's an open enrollment period in which you can re-up in the plan that you're on or start the investigation process over again and choose a new one?
That's right. The fun has just started.
One of the ways people are being advised to choose a prescription drug benefit plan is to figure out what medications you need and to find a plan that reimburses well for those medications. But what about if you develop a condition that you didn't have when you chose the prescription drug plan? What if your needs change after you choose?
This is one of the many reasons why shopping for health insurance is not like shopping for a computer or a car. Your needs are going to change during the course of the year. And if all of a sudden you get a new illness that requires drugs, you're going to have to hope that it's covered by the formulary under the plan that you're on. And if it's not, then you're going to have to work really hard with your doctor to find an appropriate substitute, or you're going to have to wait until next year. The other really bizarre provision of this is plans can drop medications during the course of the year. As long as they give 60 days notice, they can actually change their formulary. So you sign up for a plan because they're covering a certain medication. A few months later, they may not be covering that medication anymore.
Are there any provisions in the Medicare bill to help older people decide on a plan. I mean, let's be honest, a lot of older people are having memory problems or vision problems, or they don't have a computer. And it has been very difficult for many of them to figure out, you know, how the plan works and which insurance company to pick. Outside of asking children and grandchildren, is there any help provided for in the bill itself?
One of the problems is the agency that runs Medicare, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, is really understaffed, and they really don't have the finances, they don't have the personnel to provide what you need, which is one-on-one counseling to get this done. They have made provisions to fund state agencies and community groups to provide counseling. And a lot of those community groups and state agencies are the best source of information on this bill. And I think they're doing a fabulous job, but they're not enough. They're just not enough for 42 million people.
The prescription drug plan obviously has some problems. Do you agree that it's unrealistic to expect that the bill will be rewritten in a major way, that we can expect a major overhaul in the near future?
Yes. In the short term, too many people are invested in this bill politically. Too many people are invested in the program financially. Over the long term, though, I think it's a bit more unstable and hard to see where it's going to go.
Jonathan Oberlander, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Jonathan Oberlander is the author of The Political Life of Medicare. He's an associate professor of social medicine in the School of Medicine at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.